folks, hope you are having a great Wednesday morning. We've got a lot on the lineup today. We'll visit with Colonel Jeff McCausland, CBS military analyst. Discussions between President Trump and Vladimir Putin have led to the president saying he's backing out and they're just going to negotiate directly, Vladimir Putin, with Zelensky, President Zelensky of Ukraine. Is that a good thing, a bad thing, or otherwise? It seems to me that that puts Ukraine in a very difficult position, no leverage. But we'll find out from the colonel as to what he thinks about this most recent strategic move by the U.S. Joe Geruso joins us, New Orleans City Council member, District A. He's also part of the Criminal Justice Committee. He participated in the committee meeting yesterday, wherein the police chief as well as the sheriff talked about the timelines, what actually happened, what worked, what didn't work. There was a huge discussion about the city budget. I have some observations in my monologue that'll start here in just a few minutes. And as I watched that entire committee meeting, very interesting. In the 11 o'clock hour, we'll visit with Matt Wolf, VP of Communications, Greater New Orleans, Inc. Got a lot of great things to talk about, good things happening in the city. And we're joined in the back half by Jerry Bologna, President and CEO of JEDCO. And the Bicentennial Celebration in Jefferson Parish, we'll talk about that and a number of other initiatives undertaken by JEDCO as well. At 10:30, Lori Schlegel, state representative, my state rep, actually, there's a bill, House Bill 77, which would overhaul the scholarship amounts that students get from TOPS. It kind of changes a lot of the criteria. I read through the bill last evening, again this morning. Very interesting. I think there's some great provisions in there. And obviously, we'll try to find out where the breakdowns were that caused a lot of this reform, and to a certain extent, as it relates to TOPS. So the saga of the prison escape continues. Over 200 law enforcement officers from around the region assisting the Orleans Parish Criminal Sheriff's Office, Sheriff Susan Hudson, in trying to regroup and gather these individuals back up again. Five down, five more to go. I think it's important that we thank everyone that has been putting in an extraordinary amount of time and effort into capturing these individuals. This is not easy work. You follow a bunch of dead ends all the time, but you got to run them out. You got to run the leads out. It takes a lot of human capital. It's going to be very, very difficult. It could go on, and I'm really not surprised, but in some way, a little bit that they were able to capture five. And so five more to go. And we wish them the best of luck. Godspeed and safety, right? These are not your ordinary criminals. These are violent criminals. These are individuals that who would participate in a prison escape don't care what the sanctions may be. The notion of deterrence, the fear of apprehension, and detention is not there, right? They can't imagine for a moment that they were going to escape from this jail and that they would actually stay free for any particular length of time, right? No, none of that. So this is a bad, bad situation. And then came the Criminal Justice Committee meeting, which highlighted that it's potentially even worse. And I have to give Sheriff Susan Hudson credit. I think she was totally transparent, quite frankly, in most respects, especially when she said that today, yesterday meaning, May the 20th, on the Tuesday, 5 days after the escape, there's nothing going on in the jail that's any different than what was going on in the jail on Friday. The same challenges, the same lack of human capital. Not sure whether or not the protocols were sufficient enough to overcome the deficiencies of human capital, the deficiencies of locks that don't work, and any other deficiencies that have come to the forefront as a result of this preliminary investigation, look-see by a number of different agencies. A lot of folks are inside that jail right now, continues to be on lockdown, which is probably the only difference between today and Friday. Friday before the escape. So that's where we are. Now, it's going to be difficult to keep the facility on lockdown in perpetuity. It's not going to work that way. Lawyers are going to be running into court. There's all kinds of requirements as to exercise and this and that and daylight and getting outside the whole nine yards. Restricted movement. I'm not sure if this has been a disruption to the transportation of these inmates to criminal district court. I certainly hope not. We can't afford to have more continuances. We can't afford to not have cases heard in criminal district court. We can't afford to miss dates because that's why we're in the predicament that we're in now, right? You have an arrest base, and then a certain number of these individuals that are arrested are going to bond out, whether through a cash bond system or be released on their own recognizance, and the others go to jail. And I got to imagine that the NOPD is probably making somewhere around 70, 80, maybe 90 arrests a day. That number would not surprise me. Wouldn't surprise me if it's even more. I'm just guessing. When you have 1,400 inmates and you're moving those kind of folks through the facility, they have the capacity to hold a number of these folks in the booking facility. You can't keep them there forever. It's not designed to keep them there for a long period of time. In fact, you try to move them out, which within certainly 24, 48, 72 hours would be optimal. That's not always the case. Go to any jail, you're going to see that situation that exists. The question really is that what is the right size for this facility? We've been involved in this argument before. I will remind you that this sheriff believed that it was 500 and that we would be able to put everybody else back out on the street and monitor them in some magical way, as though that was actually going to save us money. The fact of the matter is, if you're going to monitor those individuals in an appropriate fashion, in a fashion that's dictated by the violent behavior exhibited in the violation of whatever state statute they violated, it could end up costing more per day if done right. So that's the quandary where we find ourselves at the present time. What was very interesting about the process that kind of played itself out in the Criminal Justice Committee is this, and this is kind of at a granular level, but it's very important. A sheriff is an independently elected office. Some of the expenditures of that office by state statute are provided for by the parish of Orleans, the city of New Orleans, the only parish that has the same boundaries as the city. So the city totally encompasses the parish. And that's for the maintenance and upkeep of the jail. That is not an expense obligation of the sheriff. That belongs to the city. But what frustrates and creates this friction point is, and the sheriff said it as well as her CFO, they actually want to be treated as an agency of the city of New Orleans. And they want those expenses to be balanced and part of the priorities of an agency of the city of New Orleans, as opposed to the sheriff's office being a single reporting entity, which is what it is, because it is an independently elected office. They can call tax elections, they can pass millages, they can do all kinds of things that an agency can't do. The city would, but not the agency, not like the Recreation Department. They don't get to go out and unilaterally decide on their own. They have to go through the city construct in order to be able to do it. So the sheriff's office is kind of a hybrid. And the oversight of the city, who's providing a significant amount of money, providing for all of the medical maintenance and upkeep of the jail and all alike, has a desire to have to be a little bit more intrusive, to make sure where these dollars are spent, how they're spent. How do they reach these priorities? Are they getting the adequate return on their investment? And you saw that play out in the committee yesterday. Meanwhile, the House of Cards is tumbling down. Meanwhile, there are complaints of year after year after year, allegedly, of sharing of information, of not being able to get into a priority situation with an increase in the amount of funds. By the same token, the city administration says that over the last 5 years, there's been a 25% increase in the funding for the sheriff's office, far greater than the NOPD, far greater than EMS, and maybe on par with the fire department. So you have these competing value propositions going on, and all the while, every part of the equation, people think they're treating the others fairly. The others think, the sheriff's office, that is, don't think that they're being treated fairly. They say that they don't have the necessary dollars to support what they're doing. The council set a limit of 1,200 individuals, something, a number around there, as to the number of inmates that should be in the facility. There's over 1,400. At some point, and I think the Attorney General said it yesterday, there are some points here that everybody needs to come to a consensus on at some point in time. Or otherwise, we're going to be stuck on stuck. And we're not going to go very far. I mean, there was this huge discussion about a software called Brass, which is the financial software that's used by the city, and whether or not these single reporting entities like the sheriff's office, like the courts, the judges, the DA, and others that get a lot of money from the city, as to whether or not they should all be on these particular programs, so that everybody is looked upon the same way, the priority set can be the same, the matrix is out there, we're talking the same language, the same lingo, we account for dollars spent in the same way, so that we can try to compare apples to apples. Part of the issue has always been, folks, plain and simple, independently elected officials, myself included, because I had the same mindset. I'm guilty. Guilty as charged. I don't want somebody else Monday morning quarterbacking me, telling me what the priorities should be, where as a single reporting entity, I'm an elected official, and I believe that I am in a closer contact with my constituency and understanding what they want, what they desire, and how I would go about delivering it. It worked for me. The reality is, though, that the JPSO is vastly different than the OPSO. It's not the same type of agency. The funding formula and everything else had relied very little on any dollars from the parish council other than the jail. And we had much broader responsibilities than the OPSO has. But this is basically where the rubber's meeting the road. And this is a battle that has gone on, quite frankly. I worked down there from 1977 to 1980, which is when I moved to the JPSO. They were fighting about this same issue back then, in the 70s. nothing has changed. In fact, it was even worse because we had two independently elected sheriffs, a civil sheriff and a criminal sheriff. And in the aftermath of Katrina, there was some consolidation, and the civil sheriff's office went by the wayside and was incorporated into the criminal sheriff's office. It was even worse before because you had all of these same issues. Maybe, just maybe, this may be the defining moment that we're able to pull this together. There seemed to be some acceptance by Sheriff Hudson, albeit I don't know that she has much of a choice. She has suspended her election campaign. I'm sure that's because she is reading the tea leaves, hopefully, and not just trying to bamboozle the public in order to make them believe that her priorities are first the jailbreak and second getting reelected. If she reestablishes that campaign, we'll know right away. If I had to guess, it would be the day after they catch the last inmate, escapee. We'll know right away just how heartfelt this truly was, right? I have to suspect that her constituency, and if there's a poll that's done right now, she's not going to fare very well. She's clawing, trying to come back. Being very accommodating and setting out an air of accountability and taking responsibility for what actually happened. There was a lot of talk, about how money spent. And not nearly as much talk about an operational audit as opposed to a financial audit. The overlay of the financial audit, the true value of it, if you really want to get the most leverage out of that, is to lay that on top of an operational audit. As to whether or not you are running an organization with the minimum amount of WIPs, works in process, how paperwork flows, how many support personnel you have. Have you automated some of those duties in the support area? Because if you have too much money spent there, that's less money that can be spent on supervision of inmates. There needs to be an operational audit done first and a financial audit done second. In order to gain a determination as to what is the optimal funding and financing of this office? And operational audits in a jail are a lot easier than most other organizations. Why? It's a confined space. You have life safety code provisions provided for by the state fire marshal and others. They give you a number of inmates that you can have in this facility. If you have more than that, you have to go to the state fire marshal to determine. Based on the number of inmates, there are all kinds of formulas for how many employees are needed, and taking into consideration the construct of the facility. Some are more efficiently designed than others. And we get back to what I talked about yesterday, whether or not this direct supervision model is really worth its weight in salt for this organization, especially taking into consideration that you have a medium security facility and you have high security inmates that you're keeping. You have a blend, you have a hybrid, because it's a jail, it's not a prison. It's not stable. The violence complexion of that population within that facility changes daily. And that's the big, big challenge. So hopefully at the end of the day, we can put this issue to rest. We can figure out, and they said that, you know, there's a need for inventory, and that the brass system, the financial software of the city, didn't have it. Now, allegedly, they do. But the majority of what is done can be put on brass. There are a few things that are different that are going to occur in a jail that you're not going to see typically in the city budgeting process. You can make accommodations for that. It'll take little to no modification. A lot of the back end work can be done in another landscape. It's not a big issue. It's just a question of the willingness to get to where we need to get. And then, once the number is established, in all fairness to the sheriff, whether it's Sheriff Hudson or whoever may get elected in the fall, you got to fund the number. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. Because there's so many things required as it relates to inmates that you really don't have a choice. You have to provide it. Feeding, keeping, maintenance. All kinds of other things. Medical visits. The list is absolutely crazy. You don't get to prioritize those items. Someone else is telling you how this is going to actually work. And if it doesn't, then if you don't do it, you're going to court. And you're going to lose. And you're going to pay more. So it's not like putting off and delaying filling a pothole. The jail is not a pothole mentality. You're trying to keep people in a confined space that have the bulk of their constitutional protections still intact, other than to just roam freely. Everything else is still there, and some. Under the Constitution, a cruel and unusual punishment, and there's some crazy cases about what that definition is inside of a confined facility. So it's different. We'll continue to monitor this. I didn't mean to get to the granular level, but I've been asked a lot of questions here over the past several days about why are we kind of stuck on stuck? Well, this is the rub right here. This is where the rubber meets the road. Independence, wanting to be the SRE, the single reporting entity, but also wanted to be treated as an agency, to fall into the overall priorities of the city. And that's the rub. The city has a desire to do a lot of other things. Taking care of inmates is not a public, a popular subject matter. They all understand the obligation, but that or providing recreation for your kids is a difficult decision. It's not one that anyone truly enjoys. We'll be right back, folks. After the break, we'll visit with Lori Schlegel, Louisiana State Representative. We'll talk about top scholarships and how that new legislation is going to change how it's handled, and other topics as well. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We are joined by Representative Lori Schlegel. She's actually my rep. Lori, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Noel. How are you?
Doing well. How many more days left?
3 weeks. We count them down.
On the countdown, right?
On the countdown.
So let's talk about House Bill 77, kind of a rework of the TOPS program. What brought, what kind of was the moving force for you to decide to kind of change the way that TOPS is handled?
Sure. So I'm chair of House Education. And so in between sessions, we did interim meetings where we brought in like the departments and higher ed to come and just sort of take a deep dive into things. And the Board of Regents, which is over higher ed, they do a TOPS report. And so it showed me anecdotally what I already know, is that we're losing a lot of our best and brightest to out-of-state schools. And so what that report showed, within 10 years, we went from 84% of our honors level of TOPS accepting their award to 73%. So it's close to 11% decrease of our honors levels accepting their TOPS and going to Louisiana colleges. And so it just sort of proved to me what I just anecdotally knew, because, you know, I have a son that has gone to an out-of-state college. A lot of his friends did. And our schools are just not competing at the level of which some of those schools are coming to, you know, woo our children. And so I just knew that we had to do something about it to make our state more competitive in that way.
So what were the impediments that y'all identified that this bill attempts to remediate?
So what I heard from a lot of parents is, one, a lot of like Alabama, Ole Miss, they have a very predictable and knowable scholarship program. So you know if you make a certain ACT and you have a certain GPA, this is the award amount you're going to get. The only thing we have like that is obviously our TOPS award, and it does not even at the levels to which especially our best and brightest can get at some of these colleges. It just wasn't at the level of which some of these other colleges were offering. So we knew in order to be more competitive, we need to have a more knowable, predictable, you know, award opportunity for these students.
And obviously, I mean, a lot of times we don't think we're in the competition business, but we are, right? I mean, if you want to keep your best and brightest here, you have to make things predictable, and it has to be stable.
Right. And what these colleges are doing, I mean, even Alabama, I know that they have their own recruiter that's on the North Shore. I mean, so they're actively recruiting our students. They do it very early. You know, they do a very good job when you get there on their campus doing a great tour. And then obviously the scholarship program is also very competitive. So, you know, and what I can tackle, obviously, is trying to, you know, revamp some of the TOPS, especially part of HB 77 is adding this what we consider an excellence level award. And so if you have a 31 on your ACT or above and a 3.5 on your GPA, then your award amount is $12,000, and you can use that at any of our Louisiana colleges, and it pretty much covers all of the tuition and fees.
Yeah, that's a nice benefit for sure. And as I was reading through the bill, there seems to be a number of other accommodations that kind of make the use or utilization of these dollars available more flexible.
Yeah, so we started out the bill. It was definitely more broader than where it is now. It did pass the House. And so I wanted to be able to increase each one of the award levels. And so there's opportunity performance honors, and now we've added the excellence. So we started out with, of course, a broader where we were going to increase. It was going to be a flat award amount just based off of your achievement. And you can take it sort of like the money follows the child. You could take it to any of the Louisiana colleges. But in order to make LSU more whole, we also had to add a stipend to it because theirs is a little bit higher than what the average was. And so our fiscal new grew and grew and grew to where it grew too much to where I don't know if we were going to be able to pass it as is. And so we did pare it down, and now we've included the excellence level where, again, to be able to counterbalance some of our best and brightest leaving our state.
And when we look at like Alabama and others, because they've been doing this for years, right? Basically offering the same benefit as TOPS Louisiana for them to go to another school. Is this these dollars that they're putting up over there, are these state funded dollars or are these donations that are coming into the university? Do we have any clue how they're financing a lot of what they're offering?
You know, I'm not specifically, but it's not just Alabama. And I know we kind of focus on Alabama just because Alabama is one of those ones that have grabbed a lot of our students. But now Ole Miss is competing, and even Arkansas. I was actually walking through our neighborhood and was stopped by one of the parents who actually was telling me how their child wanted to go to LSU, and their scholarship award just did not compete with some of the others. And then he proceeds to tell me about him and his son and a few of their friends are now going to Arkansas. And so, you know, we're even having other states around us competing for our children. And I just feel like, you know, we need to do whatever is best in for our state to keep our children. I mean, obviously there was a point where 84% of our honor students were accepting TOPS. So I'd like to be able to at least get back up to that level. And so that's our goal with HB 77.
Well, it's critically important, Lori, right? Because, I mean, when we look at population migration, the out-migration in Louisiana has been greater than the in-migration, and this is one of the ways that you capture them is to keep them here, educate them here, and hopefully create more opportunities here, right?
I totally agree with that. And especially when I just hear stories of kids that wanted to go to LSU, wanted to go to one of our in-state schools, and just the package that they were offering, it was just not competitive. And so I know I'm not going to be able to get every child, because there's just going to be some children that want to go, obviously, out of state. But sure, for those that want to stay in state, we need to make sure that we're doing whatever it takes to keep them, because our state is so diverse. I mean, even if you live in an area and you want a different experience, I mean, and where we live, I mean, you can go to La Tech up in Ruston and have a totally different experience than living in Jefferson Parish. So I feel like for our state, and that's why we wanted to make sure it was a set award amount, and you could use that to go whatever college you want to in our state. So,
and we do have, and we know, for example, based on most recent reporting with the University of New Orleans, my alma mater, they're
my
a little bit in
too.
Trouble. And they're a little bit in trouble, right? I mean, I care about them. I mean, I firmly believe that they built the middle class here, but and these kind of things can help.
Yes, no, I totally agree. And I actually just heard a great compliment from an engineering firm. They were like, we love to hire our engineers from UNO grads because they have a great work ethic. They're knowledgeable. And so, yeah, we don't want to lose that. I know, you know, the Senate president is working on how we can, you know, best make them more solvent. I do believe that, you know, being able to keep, you know, the best and brightest, and then being able to have, in a sense, free tuition and fees to go to UNO. And so hopefully this will help our state to be more competitive.
Lori, I know that you authored a number of bills this year. What are some of the top things that you've been concerned about, and have you been, and where are they through this process?
Sure. Well, I mean, obviously, you could tell a lot of my bills, I do public safety, I do protecting children. I'm very passionate about that. And so I have a few bills to try to help protect children online. Unfortunately, we're starting to see, and even in our own state, there was a case in Washington Parish where a child was groomed online, and the gentleman from New Hampshire came and sexually assaulted this child, and DA Sims actually just prosecuted this case, and he was found guilty. And this is becoming just more and more of an issue. I know our AG was telling me about this group called 764, where it's an organized network where they're going onto the platforms that kids are on, games and social media, and they're grooming these children and having them send sexually explicit pictures. And so I do have a few bills to tackle to make, you know, these companies that are engaging with our children, having them to have a duty of care, where if you're going to contract with a minor, that you better make sure on your platform and games that there's certain guardrails in order to protect children. And so that is actually awaiting. I'm hoping to get, I'm going to have my, it's already passed the House and now on to the Senate.
Yeah, very, very important. And it seems to be more and more prevalent and more in, and a big challenge, not only for law enforcement, but parents and alike, right? I mean, you know, I tell folks all the time, you got to be more intrusive. I'm glad I'm beyond those years now. But it was like, you know, it was never a dull moment, ever, for sure. Well, Lori Slagle, thank you so much for thank you. I'm sorry. Thank you so much for joining us. We got to get to a break. We really appreciate your time and your insight, and best of luck in the remaining 3 weeks of this session.
Thank you so much. Yes, thank you. Have a good day.
That's Lori Slagle, state representative in Metairie, my state rep. We will be right back, folks. Stay with us. So I was glad to see that they are making some changes in order to become more competitive in the market relative to TOPS. It's incredibly important that we stay current. We understand what our other SEC universities are doing in trying to pick the best and brightest away from us. And that's not a good thing. And when you look at that number dropping roughly 7% of top graduates leaving, going to other schools. You know, the experience set here, we got to make sure that we look at that a little bit more closely and make sure that we stay competitive. So I applaud Representative Lori Schlegel for her work as the chairman of education and moving forward with this. I know that there's, as she said, there was a desire to do more, but it's the dollars just are not available. Got a number of texts earlier, folks asking about a line of questioning that occurred during the Criminal Justice Committee meeting of the New Orleans City Council yesterday, wherein there was a question asked of Sheriff Hudson as to the bonding capacity of the sheriff's office. And, you know, there were folks that were kind of saying, well, why wouldn't she know that number? You know, the fact of the matter is it's not something that you would pull out right away. There's a whole process that you have to go through. You got to go, you know, to committees of the state in order to state bond commission in order to get approval. You have to get bond lawyers involved. There's a lot of moving parts. There are things that are very fluid, interest rates, availability, a duration, what your expense set is at any given time. As they kind of described the budgetary issues that they were having and the float, I don't know, you know, exactly what the picture is. I mean, it's a process that might be worth going through. I don't know how much money they would end up getting or qualifying for. It's a burden. You know, I know that not long after I became the CFO of JPSO back in, I think it was 1994, if my memory serves me correct, we used to borrow money in August to make payroll through the first of the year. And it was a practice that no one actually liked it. My predecessor didn't either. And working with him when I was named and others, we were able to posture the budget so that we wouldn't have to borrow money. We didn't have to go to the bond commission and create debt, because you just can't create that type of debt on a whim. And so it was great to be on a cash basis, and been on a cash basis ever since. I think we floated a couple of bond issues because interest rates were so low. There were some other projects that we wanted to fund, and so we did it, paid them off early, and moved on, and it had been on a cash basis ever since. And I suspect that the present sheriff is still on a cash basis. And, you know, it's always good to be able to do so. Sheriff's offices don't have big, big capital projects, so it's much easier to do so. So I wasn't surprised that she didn't know the number, and I wasn't surprised that the CFO didn't know the number. It's a business decision you make in deciding as to whether or not you want to go create that long-term debt. Obviously, they've not had those conversations yet. They've not put the feelers out to see whether or not how much money they would qualify for and what the landscape is. Is a landscape favorable right now or not? These are all things that are very, very fluid. We'll be back, folks, right after the break. Stay with us.